Joe Buck has joined us here on Sports Byline. There's an adage, and I don't know whether it's true or not, but I'd like to get your perspective on it, Joe, and that is that a good game will get a good broadcast, a bad game will get a mediocre broadcast.
Here's my experience. A good game will cover up a lot of flaws. A bad game will expose somebody that's not ready and takes a lot more work. That's how I would describe it. I think sometimes your best work can come in a bad game. And I've had many broadcasts where I've walked out of the booth and I've either seen our executives at Fox or I've talked to friends or whatever on the phone, and like, oh boy, that game stunk. And I'm thinking, that was one of my better games of the year, because you have to try and keep the plate spinning and keep things going, and that's a lot more work. A Super Bowl that's coming down to the fourth quarter with the lead going back and forth, you can take your hands off the handlebars on that. And, you know, you talk about just highlighting the action and letting the action carry it. I mean, to me, that's the epitome of it. So, you know, it kind of works in reverse. And I've done plenty of games that were great, and I thought, man, I just was off, or I had some things I wanted to take back, and nobody cares. And it just doesn't work that way in a bad game. And so it reminds you every time, Ron, that, you know, the game is why people are watching or listening. And if I get hit by a bus on the way in, they're still going to play. And likely they're not going to have a moment of silence. They're still going to play, and we'll just go on about life. And that's why people are watching or listening, and it kind of puts things in a better perspective.
Let me take you back to 1994 for a second. You were 25 years old when you broke in with Fox, and think about the technology that was used in broadcasting network games at that time, and fast forward to today and the technology that's being used. How much more difficult is it in the broadcast booth with today's technology than it was back in 94?
Well, there are more bells and whistles, and a lot of it can be a great aid to you. I don't think there's been anything in the NFL that's been better than the camera that sits behind the quarterback. I love replays from that angle, and I love to hear Troy Aikman's thoughts about what he's seeing and where he would be looking if he were, you know, 12 feet lower than that camera actually on the field. I think that's great. Microphones and bases in baseball. Interviews with managers or players that are involved in the game, in the bullpen or in the dugout, there's a lot more traffic and there's a lot more going on. And so, you know, when I'm doing an NFL game, the sound is so good from the line of scrimmage that oftentimes I'm trying to just squeeze in down and distance, because if I'm at home, I'd rather hear Aaron Rodgers yelling out the snap count or where the middle linebacker is, or I want to hear natural sound as a fan, and I hate as a broadcaster stepping on that. So it's required more of a dance. So it's a little bit of a trickier world, but I think a better world, because it serves the viewer better at home.
And also, there's a lot of multitasking that goes on in the broadcast booth. You've got your producer in one ear, also your director, maybe sometimes in the other ear. You've got Troy, if you're doing football, on one side. You got a stat guy. You also have a spotter for you, and then you have a production assistant that's in the broadcast booth as
right.
Well. Does it get difficult to keep things simple so that it'll be a polished broadcast?
Yeah, I think it can get difficult. I think the one thing you can eliminate is the spotter. I think if I'm not good enough to know that number 80's Jimmy Graham, who's a gigantic tight end, and I need to look down and somebody has to point to Jimmy Graham having made the catch, then I shouldn't be standing there. So I don't really rely on the spotter as much. That is still in my real estate. And to me, and I have a great spotter, great guy, but I'm required to do more than just kind of show up and say what name somebody's pointing to. So that I try to eliminate. The stat guy I lean on more than anybody. I am numbers dumb. I'm not good at it. A run will start at the play will start at the 40 and it'll be tackled at the 42, and I'll look over to my left and he writes like, okay, moron, that was a 2-yard run. So that's how reliant I am on the stat guy. The editorial consultant's behind me. He stays away from me unless I really ask him. So this is all a long way of saying, if you let things get in between you and listening to the analyst, then you're really headed for trouble. And so Troy and I have talked many times, and sometimes I remind Troy, you know, it's great to call for the replay, but sometimes I'm either saying what you're about to say, or you just repeated exactly what I said, or I'm asking you something and you're not getting the full gist of it because we're not really listening to each other. So that's the main thing, and everything else falls in after that.
You know, one of the things that I like about your presentation, both on baseball and football, is that you make it conversational. Many of us that are in this profession try to be broadcasters instead of communicators, and that's something that I don't know whether it was a natural part of your progression as a broadcaster from the very beginning, or it's something that developed over time.
Yeah, I think it developed over time. I think it comes with being comfortable. You know, when I was 27 doing my first World Series, I was scared to death. I mean, and you get those, every broadcaster, I'm sure you have it, you have those dreams where you're not prepared, or you wake up and you don't know the teams, or you don't know. Well, that's, I think, running through everybody's mind. And when I was 27, I was deathly afraid of being exposed as a fraud. You know, you're somebody's kid, and you shouldn't be sitting there, and you shouldn't be doing the games. And I think the more you do, and the more you kind of get the benefit of the doubt, I think you can be a little bit more relaxed, and I think you can be a little more conversational. But I think that comes from my dad's style a little bit, and I think that also comes from being my dad's son. I mean, this was always kind of a part of my daily dialogue, and I was around it as a kid, and so it seems natural to me, and it wasn't kind of the end-all. It was kind of assumed by me, and I never assumed I'd be doing all this stuff, but I thought someday maybe I could follow in my father's footsteps, and I was lucky enough to get the chance. And I say that without trying to sound cocky. I just say it because this is how I grew up, and so this wasn't like this far-off dream, and when I do it, I'm going to sound like everybody else. I just wanted to sound like myself, and that's just kind of how that's evolved.
You know, all of us in this profession that have been in the broadcast booth hope that we have an opportunity to call one great moment. You certainly had that opportunity on September the 8th, 1998. For me, it was 1982, Stanford against Cal. You know how it ended up with the ladder all over the field. You at least knew that there was a possibility that there could be a home run from Mark McGwire. But tell me a little bit how you approached that game.
Man, that was a great lesson for me, Ron, because, you know, when you're doing something like that, and it's kind of the countdown to the big home run, and forever, I mean, I worked with Mike Shannon, who I've mentioned, and he was a teammate of Roger Maris's, and he said, nobody will ever break it, because I saw what Maris and I used to talk about, what he went through when he was chasing down Babe Ruth's record, and it was crippling, and we all know how that played out, and what that did to him that year, and losing his hair, and all the issues he went through off the field with the stress involved. Well, now it just looks like a foregone conclusion in 1998 that he's going to break the record, and then everybody starts asking you, well, what are you going to say? I mean, what are you going to say when this great moment happens? And I my answer for the first month of that was, I have no idea. I don't know what I'm going to say tonight when it, pick the player, Pedro Guerrero. Well, he was gone by then, but whoever. Ozzie Smith or Pat Kelly or whoever. That just, my career is, as you said earlier, filled with moments you don't know are coming, and you have to react when they happen. So I blew that off, and then more people asked me, and then I started to go to bed thinking about what I was going to say, and I woke up thinking about what I was going to say, and I wrote something down in my scorebook, you know, some dumb thing I thought of when I woke up one morning, and I had it there, but because of the ball he hit to break the record for 62 was so low, it almost didn't get over the wall, and it was so down in the corner, it was almost foul. I had to watch the ball the whole way and make sure it was a home run, and I could never get my eyes down to what I was going to say in my little script that I had written. So I just kept my head up, and you know, you have to make sure it's a home run or you'd be laughed out of the business. And then because of that, I saw how happy he was, and I saw him leap over first base, and that became part of the call. Touch first, Mark, you're the new single-season home run king, is what I said, which I hadn't planned at all. But I saw it because I had my head up, and that's how we all have to do these moments instead of trying to script them. And I won't do it ever again in my career, and I just have to live with whatever comes out of my mouth.
We have about 45 seconds before we have to break, Joe, but when you think back, and if you do listen to the call of that home run, What is it that pleases you the most about it?
The excitement and the raw sound of it, and it didn't sound rehearsed. And you know, I've never really even thought about that question, but that's the answer. It didn't sound rehearsed, and I know in my mind and in my heart that I had no idea that I was going to say that. It's like my dad with a go crazy, folks, go crazy thing when Ozzie Smith hit a home run. He was kind of ashamed of it at first, but it was a raw, natural moment, and those are always the best.
Joe Buck has joined us here on Sports Byline, and when we come back on the other side, we're going to talk about something that he did extraordinary in his career. It happened in 2012 when he called a 49ers game in the afternoon and then went and did a playoff game with the Cardinals and the San Francisco Giants in the evening. And we're also going to talk about a phrase that he uses from time to time to honor his father. The phrase is, "We'll see you tomorrow." It's a very interesting phrase and has a great story behind it as well. We continue across the country and around the world with you on Sports Byline.